Foreigners are sneaking in through the wide-open borders of the New World Order, and they are snatching our land away. Some say these invaders are invasive and should be removed. Others say there is nothing that can be done about them, and we must learn to accept them. This leads us to ask, should we eliminate or tolerate non-native plants?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 612th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Cusco who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello, everyone.
And Parmley Taff is orbiting about somewhere. Folks, consider this brief description of California's Central Valley way back there in the 1800s, and it's from naturalist John Muir. The Great Central Plain, during the months of March, April, and May, was smooth, continuous bed of honey blooms, so marvelously rich that in walking from one end of it to the other, a distance of 400 miles, your foot would press about 100 flowers at every step. Just think of it, a veritable paradise. And yet, while strolling through Bidwell Park in Chico, California one recent day, I came upon a scene that would have devastated the great naturalist. Where there was a forest of baby oaks, wildflowers, and a riot of biological diversity, there is now only a thick blanket of brome grass, which you may know as foxtail. Quite literally, this foreigner had slipped into the country and snatched a big chunk of Bidwell Park. And if left to its own devices, it will likely snatch the rest of Bidwell Park as well. Later in the day, I read an account of this devastation in a local newspaper by a plant ecologist, Virginia Moran, who says that alien plant life appears to be taking over much of the American landscape. In California alone, the invaders are estimated to cause $33 billion a year by destroying forage for livestock and wildlife, increasing fuel loads for wildfires, and consuming acre feet of precious water. And you know how precious water is in this state. So this devastation leads us to ask, should we eliminate or tolerate non-native plant species? And here to help us hunt for an answer, we have that plant ecologist that whose story I read up there in Chico. Her name is Virginia Moran. She's with Outreach, which is a environmental consulting firm, right, Virginia?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's my own company.
And what do you do?
Well, I am an environmental educator and environmental consultant, and I come across this question constantly about what to do about invasive plants and if it's too late. And I get some very bizarre requests sometimes. One of the requests I got not too long ago was a woman who did some improvements on her property, and mustard came in on her property, which she had never had before, black mustard. And she called me and asked me where it came from and how it got on her property, and now it's taking over her property. So a lot of what I do is actually educating small landowners and private landowners about basic ecological principles.
Mm-hmm. And of which nobody else is teaching us, so you may as well do it, right?
Well, yeah, and that's one of my gist of the article was that I really think we're leaving the green out of the green movement. I don't mean in any way to disparage the average American or the Californian, but most people are profoundly unaware of native plants and the plants that grow on their property and the dynamics between when you disturb the soil. Yes, you will get weeds that come in now, and we're seeing this with a lot of the thinning programs in our national forests and our national parks, and they're going in and they're fire clearing, supposedly for human health and safety, but the annual grasses are then coming in. We're not getting native flora back where we disturb these sites anymore, and that's making a lot of scientists think, is it too late? It might be.
Well, what would John Muir say if he were to take that stroll I took through Bidwell Park in Chico? Folks, if you haven't been to Chico, it's a beautiful park right in the middle of town. It's kind of like California in that it's a riot of diversity, but a beautiful place, absolutely stunning place to walk in the autumn because it's kind of like New England, I guess, you know, it'd be really beautiful. But what would John Muir say were he to see what has become of the landscape?
Well, I think he'd be heartbroken, but I also think that there's something inevitable about what's happening right now. We are the dominant species on the planet, and we bring these critters with us. You know, there was just a show on public television about the quagga mussel. We're disrupting ecosystems all over the world, and it is, in fact, linked to the human species. And we're moving into a global ecology. It's not just a global economy, but it's a global ecology. And I had to laugh because some of the editors at Chico News and Review said, "My God, Virginia, everything in this photograph is from Europe. You know, are we in Europe?" And it's like, well, yeah, a lot of what dominates our landscape in California now, particularly in the Central Valley, are species introduced from the Mediterranean and Asia and Europe. There are dominant species on our landscape now.
What about brome grass?
Brome is definitely introduced from the Mediterranean. It does great here because the Mediterranean climate is where it naturally occurs, and we have a Mediterranean-type climate here. And it also thrives on disturbance. It also thrives
what,
on...
What do you mean it thrives on disturbance? What does that mean?
That means soil movement, pretty much of any kind, whether you're clearing brush from your property or you're building a house. Anytime you disturb basically the top 6 to 8 inches of soil, that used to occur naturally through ungulates and mm-hmm. some migration movements of wildlife, and maybe even Native Americans would stimulate seed germination. Now what's in the seed bank is mostly weeds. And they're weeds for a reason. They're good at what they do. And they take advantage of disturbance. So you disturb the soil, and the next thing you know, I'm getting a phone call, you know, from saying, why do I have mustard on my property? I never had mustard on my property before. Well, you disturb the soil. Somehow the seeds got in the seed bank. And they have a party when you disturb the soil.
Sure.
They germinate their brain. You know, this is why they're weeds. They're good at what they do.
In that regard, can we say all native plants are good and all non-native plants are bad?
Oh, man. Well, I think I might have told you, Michael, that when I proposed this story to the Chico News and Review, and it's my second story, first of all, I had to sell it to them because mm-hmm. they didn't see a story here. And mm-hmm. and bless their hearts, I was able to tell them, yeah, there is a big story here. And I was able to mention what's going on in Bidwell Park. But the other thing I did is I interviewed 9 scientists, and my idea was this was going to be a slam dunk, right? Everybody's going to say non-native plants are bad. You know, no, that's not what happened. I got an incredible diversity of opinions, and one of the people I interviewed was a rancher, a former rancher. And his opinion was, no, I like the non-native plants on my property. It's what a lot of what my cows eat are the non-native plants here. So, you know, it's basically the responses from these scientists were not consistent. Not everyone agreed with me because that was the premise I started on. All non-native plants are bad. And no, that was not what I got from these interviews.
Then what is good and what is bad?
Well, like I said, I think this is an inevitable part of the human species we're going to bring these things with us. And I really don't think there's anything we can do about it. You know, one of my friends calls people in the Native Plant Society. We do have the California Native Plant Society here in the state, a bunch of sentimentalists. Okay, I've been called a sentimentalist. And the logic on that is it's too late. Wild oat isn't going anywhere. The brome grasses aren't going anywhere. Medusa head isn't going anywhere. And you people are all just a bunch of sentimentalists who want that old landscape back, the John Muir, and it's never going to happen. So we need to just accept these plants, find uses for them. You know, they're part of our land, create a classification system for them and just deal with it because they're not going anywhere. And so what this links into is public funding, because I have to ask you what you think about this. Should public funding, sometimes in the millions, be spent to eradicate these non-native plants if it's just a patchwork on the ecosystem and we're not really eradicating them from the state? What do you think? Is that a good expenditure of public funds?
And Virginia Moran, that's the perfect question of the week. Should we take our money and spend it to eradicate these plants that we consider invasive, troublesome, costly? Should we go after them, or should we learn to just get along with them? Folks, this is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Today we're talking about the plants that come in and snatch our land from us, the invasive species that we bring in with us. We have Virginia Moran with us, who is a plant ecologist with Eco Action. Is that right, Virginia?
Ecological Outreach Services.
Good.
Yeah.
And where are you located?
I'm in Grass Valley, California.
And the question of the day is, should we spend our money on these weeds? 831-479-1080, 800-624-2665. Right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, I was strolling through the park one day, relatively recently, as a matter of fact, Bidwell Park in Chico, California. A riot of plant diversity, kind of like California itself. And I came upon a big patch of this beautiful park that was being literally taken over by brome grass or foxtail. Nothing existed on the floor of the park except brome grass. It had managed to snuff out all other life. So the question, you know, on the table today, as we speak with Virginia Moran, who is a plant ecologist, and with Ecology Outreach in Grass Valley, California. And we're asking you whether we should spend our money to control these invasive plants. And there are a lot of them. So, Virginia, how do you approach this issue? Should we or shouldn't we?
Well, first of all, Michael, as you know, you don't have to go to Bidwell Park to see these plants.
They're everywhere, of course.
Yeah, you can go outside the station there and walk down the alley, and there'll be one of them waving at you. So, I think I agree with, if you read the article, Dr. Tom Griggs with the River Partners in Chico made a really good point that, you know, now we're at the point where pretty much all we may be able to do is control, not eradicate. So, and the way a lot of people are approaching this is by functionality. For instance, tamarisk is a non-native plant that basically can eliminate water overnight from a creek or a riparian or a stream system. Just suck it away. I have seen restoration projects where they have gone in and cut this stuff, and you know, there's the whole issue of herbicides. They use herbicides. And within a week, there's water on the surface of this creek where there hadn't been water for years. So tamarisk is not one that you can ignore. And, you know, giant reed grass is another one. Arundo donax is another one you cannot ignore. They just trash riparian systems. And so what I think of it as is a triage. I think it's almost at a triage point where you pick the most severe non-native that has the most severe impact on your ecosystem, and that's the one that you go for. But the wild oat grass that's out in the parking lot right now, you know, it's all over the state. I don't know if we might have to send up the white flag on a lot of these non-native annual grasses. If people have suggestions or opinions on that, but, and then I have asked the California Native Plant Society to produce a series of maps We need to know what percentage of the California landscape has actually been taken over by these plants now. You know, because I truly believe the herb layer in California, and I mean the flower layer, is going extinct. And we need an assessment of this.
You had, when I was talking with you, you had an interesting comment with respect to the plants. You called them the skin of the earth.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Well, plants are, you know, human skin is the largest organ of the human body, and plants are the largest organ of the earth. They are the skin of the earth, and it's amazing how they just go so disregarded. My mother told me about when she was a little girl and she was in school, I guess it would be the equivalent of elementary school, back in Corning, New York. She had spelling, she had math, she had, you know, all the basic courses, but she also had a course called floriculture. And she had to learn the plants. And the kids went out and learned the names of the plants. They were tested on the names of the plants. They learned some of the medicinal uses. They learned what animals eat the plants. And I firmly believe that that's missing from our curriculum on a national level. I think that if our kids got botany, yes, I'm using the word botany, and kind of demonized, if our kids learned botany, if that was part of the curriculum, that we wouldn't see ourselves in kind of the ecological mess that we're in now. So I definitely think there's a component of education that's missing with this whole topic.
Okay, that's an interesting observation. Plants are the skin of the earth. Mm-hmm. And if we don't learn about them, then we are in trouble. Folks, phone numbers today, 831-479-1080, 800-624-2665. We're with Virginia Moran. With Eco Outreach, Grass Valley, California. She works with landholders who are puzzled by how plants are snatching their land away. Let's go to the phone and see what we have on the line. We have John. Welcome to the food chain. Are you there, John?
I am. I didn't hear you. My question is that we have the beautiful Monterey Bay, and they do everything they can to keep non-native plant life out of the bay, out of the water, and we here we have these eucalyptus trees that are taking over, and nobody seems to care. And I see the acacia now are mm-hmm. also beginning to take over,
yeah.
at pampas grass, and if we're so concerned about the bay, why aren't we concerned about the land?
Well, Virginia, is eucalyptus an invasive species?
Oh, boy. I could get stopped for saying yes. If I was in Rancho Santa Fe in San Diego and I called eucalyptus an invasive species, I could possibly be shot because they love their eucalyptus down there.
I think some of them do.
They're not native, okay? If we go strictly to the basic mm-hmm. definition, no, they're not.
What is the base definition of native? Native plant?
Well, I want to get back to the caller, though, real quick.
Okay, go ahead.
On the logic, because... And I think it gets back to that Monterey Bay is an ecosystem, and a pampas grass in somebody's front yard, that pampas grass has an ornamental function, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It functions as an ornamental. Monterey Bay, though, is an ecosystem, and so you tend to see public funds spent on ecosystem-based projects, because if salicornia or some non-native plant gets into Monterey Bay, there's a chain reaction, okay? And it can affect a whole host of other species. So if that ecosystem collapses, the marine ecosystem could collapse, the estuary ecosystem could collapse. So I think the caller's question is excellent, is that why is the eucalyptus line our roads? But I think the logic behind that is if the plants support an ecosystem, they're going to be prioritized for being removed. Whereas somebody's pampas grass in their front yard, yeah, that's too bad it's there, but it has an ornamental function, and it doesn't threaten the ecosystem possibly as much. So I hope that answered the question.
Good. Let's go to Tom, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Tom, welcome to the food chain. You've got Virginia Moran and Michael Olson.
Yeah, and I guess my comment kind of is related to the eucalyptus and whatnot, and that is that with eucalyptus and Scotch broom and those type of plants, when you try to remove them here, the permit processes and the restrictions that you have to go through are so expensive in my own personal experience, trying to remove some that were close.
You mean you have to get a permit to remove scotch broom?
Well, if you want to, if it's near, and I'm speaking in my own experience, near riparian quarters and stuff, you have to have all kinds of permits from at least three different agencies. It's very expensive. Then you have to have a plan to come back in, reestablish the native habitat, and it's so expensive to go through that process that a landowner that would like to get rid of that stuff, the cost is so high and so complex, a landowner can't, typical landowner could never do it. And I think you'd have more control of some of this stuff if you had more cooperation from the bureaucracy in terms of eradicating it. And it's a threat. See, you get, I personally have a situation where we've got some trees that we feel, you know, should come down, just as a matter of safety, we'll say. They're a threat. But because of where they're located, that process is so complex and so expensive that the tree remains. And it's, in this case, eucalyptus. And it makes no sense. It should be gone.
So Tom, do you think that we should invest our public monies into an agency that would manage these riparian corridors, manage the invasive species along these riparian corridors?
Well, I think that it has been proven with some of the work that's been done on grass waterways and some of the stuff we've done on the coast here in terms of agriculture, that if you put a cooperative system together and you eliminate the multiple bureaucracies that you've got to deal with, the landowners will do it. Private landowners will do it. Yeah.
Okay, good. We're going to have to take a quick break. This is The Food Chain.
Right.
Michael Olson here. We are talking with Virginia Moran and you. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Pick up your phones. Join us. Should we invest our public monies into controlling non-native plant species? Right back. Well, they sneak into the country through the wide open borders of the New World Order, and then they snatch our land away. They are non-native plants, and some call them invasive, and suggest that we have to go after them, grab the shovel, grab the hoe, get out there and dig them up and destroy them. But others are saying, well, hey, it's just too late for that. You're going to have to learn to live with these critters and what they do to our environment. We're here today talking about non-native plant snatchers with Virginia Moran, who is with Eco Outreach up there in beautiful Grass Valley, California. Virginia, do you have any trouble with invasive species in Grass Valley?
Oh, well, that's a loaded question. First of all, you know, it's all over the place, Michael, not over the West. But, well, this area
it's
where
all over
I live,
the United States, isn't it?
Yes, it's all over the United States. Now we've got non-native earthworms destroying the forest back east.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it's just that we're just kind of a mess of non-native species. So, but
it's
area,
in the plant species are kind of like people, you know. We just all pile in here we do our thing, and isn't it going to be, you know, whoever is most adaptable will win? Isn't that the Darwin theory of evolution going on here?
And the key is, what are you going to be, if you're a plant or an insect or a snail, or what do you have to be most adaptable to? And that is the human species. So the plants that can adapt to us the best are the ones that are going to survive, and that's what we're seeing, with the tremendous loss of natural biodiversity as the cost. So, but where I live, it was mined, and as you know, that Nevada County was its background, and they're actually
lots of earth moving around, going around.
And logging. And so, like, if I'm looking out my backyard window right now, I don't see a single native plant on the in the herbaceous layer. I have my oak trees, but there's nothing native growing on the ground level. Yeah, not in my backyard. No.
Huh. So all of the natives have been relegated to extinction, I guess.
Well, there's local extinctions, but I can find a few natives, like down in the ditch where the deer can't get to them, or hunkered around some rocks where the brown grass can't quite get in. There's a few pockets of them on my property, but most of it is dogtail grass. My property is dominated by a grass called dogtail, and it's, again, from the Mediterranean. You know, there's a theme here.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phones, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Oh, wanted to ask you really quickly, Tom brought up a good notion. Why don't we get the government to cooperate and work together to limit, to control the some of the worst species in our riparian corridors?
Well, it's happening. The National Park Service is hiring, it's actually kind of sad, but the National Park Service is hiring invasive plant technicians and botanists whose sole purpose is to identify invasive plants and come up with plans to remove them. There's also cooperative. I wanted to tell the caller, I agree that I was working with one landowner, and we did get into kind of a permit nightmare in trying to take out some invasive plants. And so sometimes that can occur, and that's why we have to train the staff of these agencies in botany. But there are programs that give grants to landowners to remove invasive plants, and you want to check with your local resource conservation district, and you want to check with the Natural Resources Conservation Service. It used to be the Soil Conservation Service. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has a challenge grant program. California Department of Fish and Game. Those programs actually are out there. You have to do a little footwork and make some phone calls. But in some cases, yes, you can get a grant to remove invasive plants from your property.
So maybe can get one government agency to go to bat for you against another government agency, right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yeah, you do have to get permits, but someone brought up the idea, and you're kind of alluding to it, that do we need a national program? I mean, we have the Obama administration coming in now. Do we need a national program of invasive plants that is a department under the Department of Interior whose sole purpose is to inventory and monitor and remove invasive plants across the nation?
Maybe that will make a good Job Corps thing for what they had in the Depression. Let's go to the phones, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Here is Bob. Bob, welcome to the Food Chain.
Oh, what an opportunity to speak with a California ecologist. I hear the word native, and I'm not quite sure that it has a definite meaning. For most people, it seems to be before the Mediterraneans arrived. But I'm kind of more interested in California before the megafauna extinction, when we had
What do you mean megafauna extinction?
Before the mammoths and the caminids, the large beavers, and a lot of herd animals, and the predators too, the saber-toothed tigers and so on, before they were before they disappeared. We won't.
Was that during the Roosevelt administration?
Well, near the end of the last ice age.
Oh, okay, a little bit before that.
California didn't have a fire-based ecology at that time. Fire-based.
Virginia, what does he mean?
Fire-based is an anthropogenic thing now, but our ecosystems now, it's generally thought, evolved with fire and developed adaptations, if not advantages, to being burned. And that's considered a fire-adapted ecosystem, where you do just fine after a fire. In fact, you thrive or do better after a fire.
Right. My point being that before the Siberians arrived and changed the ecology involving the ruminants and the browsers and so on, that we did not at that time have a fire-based ecology. To the best of our, the best evidence.
So you're talking real native plants.
Yeah, well, there may have been something before that. Yeah, to me that's more native, and I herd animals for a living, and the type of plants that grow in my pasture co-evolve with my cattle and sheep and so on, and it's a little different than a nature preserve. I'm interested in listening to what your guest has to say.
Virginia, animals and plants.
Well, it's...
Thank you for the call, Bob.
Thank you, Bob. See, here's the other paradox with that. I worked on an open space preserve in San Diego that had been grazed for about 75 years by cows. And the Nature Conservancy acquired it and promptly pulled the cows off. Well, what do you think happened? What
weeds.
Happened is the non-native grasses went nuts and had a party and took over the preserve because we pulled the cows off. And so now they are doing some very highly monitored grazing. They've put the cows back to keep the foxtail under control. So there's another question is, have we changed things so much that now we need the sheep and the cattle to control the invasive grasses? And in some cases, they're using it as a management tool now.
Wow. Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking with Virginia Moran, Eco Outreach, Grass Valley, California. Virginia visits people with plant problems, the plant snatchers, people who have had their land snatched by invasive plants. What do you do? Why did it happen? And if you look at California, I guess you could say that we have been snatched. What are we going to do about it? Should we take public money and spend it to fix it, or should we just let them go? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back to the phones after these important messages. Well, they sneak into the country via the wide open borders of the New World Order and wreak havoc. They snatch our land away. In California alone, the invaders are estimated to cause $33 billion a year in damage by destroying forage for livestock and wildlife, increasing fuel loads for wildfires, and consuming acres, feet of precious water. And, boy, you can sure see the whole notion of increasing the fuel load for wildfires with the eucalyptus and whatnot in coastal California. When those things catch, they just explode. What kind of damage can these invasive species do, Virginia Moran?
Well, as we've been talking about, you have to define damage.
Yes, that's right.
Because
what's
like
damage
said,
to one might not be damage to another,
right? Perhaps one of the most confounding things for me was doing some research on one of our most invasive plants here, Torulus arvensis, which is called hedge parsley. It's in the carrot family. It's very annoying. It has these little burr things that get my dog. It's all over my property. And I found out it was actually considered a rare plant in Great Britain.
So, what's a pest to you is a blessing to somebody else.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I welcome them to come over here and get some. And then they told me I could come over there and snatch some of the California poppy, which they consider our Escoltia invasive over there. And along with Gaultheria chalon, the chalon from the Pacific Northwest is taking over places. So I got an earful about the plants from California that they consider invasive over there.
So when it gets right down to it, it's really a matter of definition. You know, what's a pain in the butt for one is a blessing for another. So I guess before we hire an army of invasive species experts, we have to hire an army to decide which invasive species is good and which is bad.
Well, yeah, and that's why they're using functionality to kind of determine that. What kind of damage does the plant do to an ecosystem as a whole? And if it causes a lot of, like the grasses that you saw in Bidwell Park, those annual grasses now prevent the oaks from germinating. They create a thatch on the ground, and the poor little acorn cannot even get its root system through that thatch anymore. So that's a
situation. Nor can anything else. There's just nothing else there but broom grass.
I know. It's really sad. It's really sad. And so that would be one where you would say, well, this plant has a ripple effect on the ecosystem, so let's prioritize it for removal. And I think do you know how much money it would take to get, it would be impossible to get rid of all the non-native plants in California at this point. I can't even imagine how much money it would cost.
There it is.
So, you know, it's a triage situation.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking Virginia Moran with Eco Outreach, Grass Valley, California. Virginia is a plant ecologist, and we're talking about the invasion of the land snatchers, non-native plants that come in and snatch our land away. What are we going to do with it? Are we going to spend our money to get rid of them? Let's go to Gray. Gray, welcome to The Food Chain.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome aboard.
Well, thank you. I share Virginia's concern.
Are you on a cell phone?
Yeah.
I can barely hear you, Gray. Can't quite pick up what you're saying. Can you...
Okay, let me... move over just a bit and hope that it's... Is that any better?
Yes.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, exactly. So I was going to say, I share the concern about the weedy grasses. I'm an ecologist, and I studied this situation.
Have I had you on the food chain before?
Yeah, I've been
I
on
think
before.
So, yeah. Good. Okay,
in a
good.
A few years. You know, California used to have sheets of wildflowers, you know, purple, reds, and golds all over the hillsides, and tourists come from around the world still to a few of the areas to see those things. It's really incredible. If you ask, you know, why do we care about that besides nice photography and eye candy, I'd say we ought to be concerned about the wildflowers to save our pollinators. You know, we have a bee crisis.
Exactly.
And our honeybees are disappearing, and we're going to really rely on wildflowers to support the pollinators that are native in California so that they actually pollinate our agricultural crops. So there's a big link there between weeds and human health.
You mean it could actually have an impact on us?
Well, yeah. I think so. California has an amazingly rich pollinator diversity that we could be using to pollinate our crops. But those pollinators are severely endangered by the weeds.
Well, that's one of the, you know, in my little walk through Bidwell Park and seeing this forest floor completely covered by brome grass, and that's one of the things I thought is, what about the bees? What about the animals? What about...
Well, that's it. And Virginia noted that, that where agencies take livestock grazing off of land, that these weedy grasses proliferate, and I've done research in our coastal grasslands to that effect, and the Nature Conservancy's also looked in the Sacramento Valley and noticed wherever the livestock are removed, it just turns into this sea of non-native grasses, and where the patches are still intact, there's amazing quilt work of these beautiful colors of wildflowers. And I thought that kind of brings us around to your question about whether or not we ought to be spending public money to control weeds.
Should we?
I was going to say, along the coast, you know, we've now purchased 25% of California's coastline as state parks. And when state parks own those properties, they have a real resistance to livestock grazing and have removed the cattle. And now that 25% of the California coastline is just awash in these weedy grasses, and there aren't any wildflowers anymore.
Best intentions. Folks, thank you very much for the call. Great points. Virginia, are we going to have any bees left?
I'm so glad he brought that up, and that was...
You're going to have to hold it until we get back from the break, but
that's
a good question. Yeah. Are we going to have any bees left? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking non-native plants with Virginia Moran with Eco Outreach, Grass Valley, California, and you. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back to the phones. Do stay tuned. Well, they snuck into our country, snatched away our land, and caused all kinds of trouble. And so the question left is, will we have bees? Virginia Moran of Eco Outreach, Grass Valley, California. Will we have bees left when there's no longer any flowers for them to feed on?
Right. Well, that gets back to the necessity that we need to assess just how serious this is on a statewide level, because this is anecdotal, but we need to know if the colony collapse and the loss of our pollinators is linked to the type conversion of our landscape to non-flowering grasses, and I would attest that it is. But the other thing I wanted to get in real quick on this show, Michael, was
sure.
The point that I had put in my story that I took a break from driving, and there was a sign up. They're trying to restore this historic building in this little town I was in. I think it was outside of Jenner. And they're trying to raise $10,000. And I also think there's kind of a tragedy in that these landscapes before the white settler, and the definition of native plant is basically before the European
mm-hmm.
settler got here. And I understand that definition can be plastic. But the point is we fight to save these historic buildings. And but we don't see that the landscape also preserves our history. And I think it's very sad that John Muir's landscape is potentially gone now, aside from some pockets. And don't we have some responsibility to preserve the landscape before we got here and to see these native plants also as preserving part of our history? And it always blows my mind that they want to raise $1 million to save a historic building, but the landscape's been eaten by plants you know, introduced from other places. I would like to see a historic landscape movement where we identify areas that are still primarily native wildflowers of California, and then we preserve them from a historical point of view as well as ecological.
Kind of like a museum.
Well, yeah, I guess so. It's kind of sad, but I guess in a way they would be like museum pieces.
Let's go quickly to Dan. Dan, welcome aboard.
Good morning. Yes, I'm responding to Virginia's suggesting that we all learn some botany. And,
amen.
The more we all learn about where we really are,
the greener we'd become, wouldn't we?
Better caretakers we can be.
Yeah.
And we maybe share what we've learned with each other. But I want to recommend a book. I just got it. I haven't read it yet, but it's a rich cataloging of how the Native Americans actually tended the wild almost as a bonsai garden, encouraging the growth of certain plants and discouraging the growth of other plants. It's the catalog of techniques by M. Cat Anderson, Tending the Wild, Native American Knowledge and Management of California's Natural Resources for it.
Oh, that sounds like a great show.
We may be able to adapt some of these techniques, and definitely the understanding that they had to our situation now.
Dan, great thoughts. Thank you very much.
And thank you for such a very educational show.
You bet. Let's go quickly to Joe. Joe, welcome to the food chain.
Yeah, one advantage the natives had that we don't have is they didn't have to get permits from the government to use best management practices.
Amen to that. Thank you, Joe. Hey, Virginia, let me ask you quickly. We have just a few seconds left. What are they going to do in Bidwell Park about the brome grass that's eating up their landscape?
Well, it's great that you should ask. One of the people that's taken the lead on that, it's her passion, and I hope she sticks with it, is Susan Mason.
So they're actually going to do something about it?
They are. They have
just a few seconds left. Folks, this has been the Food Chain, Virginia Moran. Wow, what an hour. Thanks, Virginia.
Thank you so much.
Eco Outreach, Grass Valley, California. Check her out. Thank you very much, Virginia, and thank you all for tuning in the Food Chain. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio, right here on the Food Chain. And remember, cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.